Relentlessly advancing through the Frost Hollow like some many-limbed, gibbering eldritch horror, casting an electronic screech onto every vox frequency that will take it, this is the unrelenting, skittering, and clawing thing of rebellion, 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Our misadventure tonight takes us deep into the Frost Hollow, checking sump relay stations so the Arbides just can't cut off the signal. My backup tonight is the lead screecher of neon sewer Ripper Randy, my backup in case we need to liquidate any four-armed emperors.
Better be getting paid for this.
I mean, sure. You like Red Squig, right? Armed as always, with what some may say is an unhealthy amount of plasma weaponry and the willingness to slag first and I don't ask questions. I'm your ghost, Goblin King. How you doing, Randy?
We're living another day.
We're living another day, another dollar. Wait, another credit.
Another credit, yeah. You said there was going to be Red Squig.
There is always Red Squig. Welcome to episode 88 of Under the Hive of Madness. This is our community spotlight with Brandon Pillow Art. Brandon, thank you for joining me today for this episode. Right up top, give everybody who's listening all of the details that they might need to go companion your artwork immediately so they hear the voice and then they see the artwork.
For sure. So if all of my personal stuff you'll find on Instagram for Brandon.Pillow.Art, and all of the content I've done on YouTube has been from Probable Wargaming. So check out Probable Wargaming on YouTube and you'll find all of my painting tutorials and stuff.
Very cool. So in our community spotlights, well, let's start somewhere different. We are currently covering the Horus Heresy in the podcast. And as far as lore is going, we everything that we've done so far in our third season, this season that we're currently in, has been focused on everything from essentially the Age of Strife forward. So Age of Strife and then Unification Wars, then the Emperor making the Primarchs, and then the Great Crusade scattering the Primarchs. And now we're into the Heresy itself. And I know that you've got, when we were talking yesterday a little bit about what your favorite little tidbits of like lore and all of that were, you had mentioned some of the Horus Heresy stuff, and you specifically mentioned Loken. Loken's one of my two favorite characters, like singular character, and I'm an Eldari guy. I love the Eldari. I love pretty much all the Xenos races. I don't really play much. I mean, I almost said Black Company.
It's all good. It happens.
What? Black Legion?
Yep.
Black Legion. I'm a big Black Legion guy. as far as chaos, as far as like any humans go. But I'm pretty much, so my two favorite characters as standalones are Abaddon and Loken, which is a very weird place to be because probably two of the characters that hate each other the most at a certain point.
Sure.
But what is your, so you've read a lot of the Dan Abnett books about the Heresy. So what are your thoughts? And of course, in Probable Wargaming, you guys are doing 30K battles. So what is your general, what are your thoughts on the Horus Heresy? Let's start there.
I think, preface, I've only read the first few books that were Dan Abnett written, which I mean, from what I hear, are the best ones. So I think I'm in the clear for that.
Yeah, Dan Abnett's probably one of the best. I say one of the best authors.
Yeah, in general. And so I mean, like his character development on all of the things he does is top tier. I mean, like anybody can write like Bolter porn, but like when it comes to developing,
so much of it is that too. It's a really good place. That's a really good way to state it.
But like his character development and like it really makes you like feel for these characters and like,
yeah,
like it brings you into that world, which is great. And it also like just thinking about what a Space Marine is and like that kind of stuff and how he is like the epitome of like what that should be, but not how it necessarily is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's just like Dan Abnett did a great job with that character. It's one of those things, like I know he has a resin model, I think.
Yeah, Loken has a 30K resin model.
But like, I wish he had like his own standalone like plastic kit that like, Because like, I feel like I'm not the only one that like, they read those first few books and they're like, hell yeah, like I want more Loken stuff.
Loken is the only Imperial character. If you asked me to, if you asked me who the good guys were, I'd be like, you're missing the point. But if you really pushed me to pick a good guy, I would say like Loken. Loken, yeah. Loken and Malkador are probably the only people that I would say are actually kind of good guys. And yeah. It's a kind of. And the reason it's a kind of is because at the end of the day, the Space Marines are a fascist arm of a fascist military government.
Yeah.
Instilling yeah. fascist rules. Because the setting was written in the 70s and 80s when there was a lot of weird fascism stuff happening in Britain, and it was written by a bunch of punks. And right. like, you know. we generally come from the counterculture, so like whatever the government's doing is wrong. Doesn't matter what the government's doing, it's wrong. It just is.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, they've cleaned up the water. Doesn't matter, it was fine before, this is wrong. So always contrarian. That's how yeah. that's how gamers are. That's
how it goes. And yeah. like just like that, like the first few books, and you realize like Loken, like he finds out that like all of his friends are part of this, what's it even called?
The Warrior coin, Lodges.
The Lodges. Yeah. And he's like, are we the bads?
Yeah. Are we the baddies?
Yeah.
And we've talked about that a lot, you know, as we kind of rounded up everything that happened. And then we talked about the end of the Great Crusade and the fall of Horus and all of that. You know, Horus is wounded to a point where he's dying. And the apothecaries of the Luna Wolves at that point. Well, no, they're the Sons of Horus. They're the same. There's this really, like, everything match kicks within a super short period of time.
Yeah.
It devolves. The end of the Great Crusade, the beginning of the Horus Heresy, is like a 2-year hazy period where they're looked at as being events that take place. And because that's how history works. History overlaps. You know, the fall of the Roman Empire didn't happen in a vacuum. And, you know, when you're in high school, you learn about the fall of the Roman Empire, and then you learn about the rise of the Visigoths. And then when you're in college, they talk about the rise of the Visigoths and how that affected the fall of the Roman Empire. And like, that's kind of where it is. As the Great Crusade is ending, is coming full circle, that's as the heresy is starting. But it was such the heresy. The horse heresy. but there's such a small like lightning match. Like it's you know, listening to like Dan Carlin Hardcore History or whatever, he talks about like these moments. And there's these moments like they decide to rename themselves the Sons of Horus, and then he's literally wounded like in the next battle. Mm-hmm. And then the apothecaries can't save him. And then it's half the Mournival, Loken and Torgadon. Thank you. We were trying to figure out how to pronounce his name last episode and we butchered it. But they're both loyalists, not heretic. They're not part of the lodges. They're not really involved. And they're like, Horus is dead. We need to let nature take its process. And then Abaddon and little Horus are like, no. And they yeet his body down to Davin. Mm-hmm. And then he gets resurrected. And at the beginning, Loken and even all of the Terran born Sons of Horus at that point are like, oh my God, he's back. This is the best thing that we could have ever. And then it literally takes like not that long for them to be like, oh, this is bad. Yeah. so it's really interesting how that happens. But yeah, there's definitely that. Wait, are we the baddies? I love that. That's a great way to put it. Like,
yeah, for sure. And like, it's definitely weird because like you get introduced to characters that like, obviously like Abaddon and that kind of stuff, which like, if you get into the game first and you look at all the different factions and stuff, you see him and then like, oh, wait a minute. I know how this story ends.
Yeah. Yeah. I know how this ends. Well, it's funny because we've talked to, so a big thing about the reason that we focus on lore and the reason that the podcast is kind of structured the way it is because there's a lot of collaborative storytelling when it comes to Warhammer 40K and it comes to role-playing games. And I realize that like, those aren't the same thing. Those are two different genres, but you can role-play in the Warhammer 40K universe. And the lore doesn't necessarily always support the tabletop. And the tabletop doesn't always support the lore. It's just the way that it, like a game universe works. The game has to function. But we talk a lot about story elements and why story is important, because, you know, even though we're doing the podcast through the lens of Warhammer 40K, a huge part of my background and of my focus is all about why do humans tell stories and why do humans play games? These are things that are like intrinsic to civilization existing. We have always shared stories around campfires. We have always, you know, ever since we figured out that we could dig little hollow pits in the ground and move stones back and forth, we've had gaming. And I, you know, Moncala is one of the oldest, one of the oldest games that we can track back to. And like, so these are things that just exist at the same time. And then we get into the story element of why people tell stories. And the Horus Heresy is John Milton's Paradise Lost. Like, and it's up there. It's up on the shelf. But it really is, you know, it's the story of the favored son of a god falling and what that does to the natural order of things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then like, you know, obviously they've put a lot more into it, and Rick Priestley even admits to some of this stuff in the earliest writings. Well, yeah, of course I was in the chaos gods were like this nebulous idea. And then we combined it with a little bit of like Lovecraftian and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And that's how we get to the Grimdark. And that's how we get to all this crazy stuff. And all of this stuff kind of, it's like a spider web or an octopus with its tentacles into the little different things. And it's super, it's very cool to see. How current are you with Dan Abnett literature right now?
Not very much. I've been reading, I'm on book three of the God's Ghost books.
Okay.
But when it comes to the heresy stuff, I'm like, first few that were written by him, and then the next one that was written by somebody else is where I stopped.
Okay.
Besides, I jumped and went to the Battle of Kalth and that kind of stuff for the Ultramarine stuff. But like, you mentioned, I can do it closer. You mentioned, like Horus and like
right.
the stories he was telling, and like it's almost like back to how great of an author Dan Abnett is like, so obviously going into it, most people already know that Horus is a bad guy.
Yes.
Loosely bad guy. But the way he develops a story and like how good of a person he is to his people makes him like he's a good leader. Like,
oh yeah,
I should follow him.
Yeah.
And like, which makes that turn into your head of like, maybe chaos is okay.
Oh yeah.
And like, so it definitely like, because of course, like the natural thing is like, I don't like bad. I don't want it to be. So you think, oh, chaos, I definitely don't want to be a part of them.
Yeah.
But then you read those books and you see how Horus is, and you're like, maybe I could be okay with being a bad guy.
Or if you really dig into the policies of the Imperium, they're not good.
Oh no.
It's designed that way. No faction except the Tyranids are the good guys, because no, I'm kidding. The Tyranids are definitely not the good guys. But no faction is designed to be a good guy, because you don't want to make that dichotomy when you're selling a game.
Right. But they definitely broke it. I mean, if the purpose of those first few books were to one, introduce the story and to get people into like the possibility of like, you can follow whatever faction you identify with. Like,
right.
It gives them that really. And you don't have to just be like the good guy space brains.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what it's the sympathetic framing of the characters. And then it's seeing the Primarchs as human.
Mm-hmm.
Because for all the super science and all the demigod powers and all of the crazy crap that's in them, at the end of the day, these are beings. These are humans, you know, superhumans that didn't have childhoods, that were raised in warfare.
Yep.
And what does that do? What happens when Alexander the Great survives past 27 years old? Does he become a megalomaniacal maniac? Well, of course, because he was when he was 27. He wanted to take over the entire world. He wasn't. That's not a normal. Well, I mean, I guess if you're Alexander the Great, it's normal. But like,
you don't have those thoughts. Like what?
All the time. I listened to a lot of Last Podcast on the Left, and at one point they were doing like native ads, like in podcast ads for BetterHelp. Mm. And one of the hosts was like, I want to slaughter my enemies and make my throne out of their skulls. But I don't need BetterHelp. And I'm like, if BetterHelp ever contacts us, I'm going to be like, you realize that everything we do is in this awful place called the Underhive, right? Like,
jeez.
Your toe got completely mangled by a acid banana slug this morning. Maybe you should go to like, do you really want me to? Anyway, but yeah, it's interesting because they make these sympathetic characters and then they humanize them. He humanizes them really well. And that's opposed to, you know, there's like 58 or 59. So if you search online for all Horus Heresy related content, it's like 128 stories.
Yeah, once I figured that out, I was like, maybe I'll stop here.
Yeah, but like 58 of them are actual novels. And then like there's short stories and there's compilations and there's all of that. If you're willing to go a little bit further, Gravthorpe. There we go. Yeah, I got it all the way out. He's a relatively good author as well. He wrote a couple of the really early ones as well. And then the Mechanicus book, which is like book 9, mm-hmm. is fantastic.
For me, a lot of my stuff is consumed via audiobook.
Yeah.
And so if it's voiced by Toby Longworth, there's a good chance I'll enjoy listening to it. Okay.
Do you like any fantasy stuff? We are totally not on script, but do you like any of the fantasy stuff?
I mean, I haven't got to it yet, but I mean, like, I'm a big Lizard Man fan.
Okay. I've been listening to Felix and Gottrick as they've been being released as on Audible as audiobooks. Because I read them 20 years ago. Maybe not 20. Yeah. They were released in the late 90s, 20 years ago. But I'm re-listening to them on Audible and like, I'm having a great time. Like mm-hmm. Felix and Gottrick are just, and that kind of gets back to, you had mentioned, what did you say? You said something really poignant. So we've always described, you called it Balter porn. Mm. The problem that happens, the attrition that happens with Warhammer novels is at a certain point, every single character defining change for a space marine is a nail and they are the most perfect hammer. And even if the problem resolution is not a nail, they're still going to hammer it. when you have a bolter, you stop like, oh, well, you mean we could come up with a trade agreement with these people? We totally could. They have a lot to offer us. Well, we could also kill them and take it.
What about orbital bombardment?
How about exterminatus? Yeah. Again, it's done so we can play with our little men's on our table and roll our dice and watch them explode and have a great time. But it is interesting because there is a good slog of the books that literally just turn Balter porn. Balter porn is a great way to put it. And a lot of like,
brother so-and-so talked to brother so-and-so and said, brother, we need to go to brother so-and-so and find the sword of brotherhood.
It's just Macho Man Randy Savage talking to himself. Hey, brother. Yes, brother. Brother, do you?
In a way, I also really like that. Like, but like, it's not like those aren't the stories that you're going to think about when you think about like the world. Those aren't going to come into your head. Whereas like, things like Garvio Loken are the things that are going to pop in because those characters, but like, it's just crazy. This world we live in that is, you know, this IP is like, even like, I just started the Farsight book. Cause I painted Farsight and gave him a cool base. So I was like, okay, I need to probably learn a little bit about him. And like, so
I need some lore here.
I know, it's like, I have all these Primarchs I need to do. I was like, no, I got to read all their books or listen to all their books. But, for example, like at that point, like
we'll cover them eventually in the podcast. If you want to wait,
we'll wait. We'll talk about those, but
season 4,
but for like Farsight in the book and how it relates to the universe, like them, like it's weird. How, like we also mentioned how it started and how Games Workshop were just some punks against the government, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, cause Tau has that very kind of like one Asian kind of culture vibe and also like communist China and that kind of stuff. And where is in the propaganda of that? Cause they have a section in that book. I don't know if you've read it. Farsight.
I have not.
Okay. Well, there's a section where they talk about like Tau propaganda, which is essentially anti-Imperium because they're a big battle and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And with that, it was not untrue, but seeing those kind of parallels between like propaganda of like the real world and what they said about things like America and that kind of stuff. And
How everybody got turned against each other in the Cold War.
Yeah, it's exactly that. And like, it's just like, that is cool. It's cool storytelling, you know, it's great how this entire IP is just full of that. And there's like so many factions, like the fact that we can have podcasts about this, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. And be in a third year.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And honestly, like, as we are covering events in the Horus, so we set out with this roadmap where we were going to cover the entire heresy in four episodes. We were going to talk about the first like couple of major battles, and then we were going to talk about the political disposition and how the galaxy split itself, and then we were going to talk only about the Dark Mechanicus, and then we were going to cover the Siege of Terra. Those are going to be our four episodes. And then we got into it and we're like, so two things happened. One of the things was we knew as we moved forward with the podcast that we wanted to start covering battles. So we know that like we want to do the Fall of Baal. We want to talk about the fall, not just here's 15 minutes as it applies to the Tyranids, but we want to talk about the battle. We want to cover it from start to finish, talk about some of the major characters and why your interactions happened. We want to do the Badab War. We want to talk about why that happened, because it brings in all these different factions and Space Marine chapters that no one talks about, like the Brass Scorpion, or not the Brass Scorpions, that's a unit, the Astral Scorpions. So, but there's like
Astral Claws.
There's the Astral Claws. There's some Scorpion, but like the Minotaurs, the Scorpion, the Crimson, the Renegades, now they're Chaos, but at one point they were Renegade Marines, not Chaos Marines. And like why all of that stuff exists and how those factions manipulated each other and how they work within each other. And when we got into the Horus Heresy, we realized that like all of these big 30K characters, several of which are still around in 40K, causing shit to happen, like Abaddon and Lucius, and like Loken being one of the founders of what would eventually be the Grey Knights and the Death Watch, even though those are two different organizations now, and like the foundation of the Inquisition and all this stuff, it all comes back to the Istvaan 3 atrocity and the drop site massacre. So we went from we're going to cover everything in four episodes to taking two episodes to just talk about Istvaan 3. and we left stuff out because that's like three books. like it's literally three 600 page, or like three 400 page novels that we talked about in like 3 hours. We tried.
There's so many turns you could take with that, because if you really wanted to like branch in every possible Y intersection, you could even like branch off at like the Saints and like how that leads into the Ecclesiarchy and like how that leads into all that. And then like you could probably like stretch out the heresy for like, I don't know, like 100 episodes.
Yeah, we definitely could. We're not, you know, a lot of podcasts that get into lore, because there's other we're not the only lore podcast for Warhammer 40K. I know it's going to come as a shock to all of our beautiful listeners, but there are others out there. A lot of them start with the heresy. That's where they start. And we knew that we wanted to, we didn't know what we wanted to do. We knew we wanted to talk about lore, and we knew that we wanted to get to 40K as quickly as possible. So we did the history of everything in three episodes. And it was through that we kind of realized like what our cadence was going to be. And if I were to re-record any episodes, it would be those three. I think it's episode 8, 9, and 10. They're rough. And they're rough because, again, Games Workshop and the authors that work with Games Workshop have been writing this lore for almost 40 years. And to put down almost 40 years of content into three episodes because we wanted to talk about like the state of the universe in 9th/the coming of 10th was just a really weird goalpost. Are you looking for the publication date?
Yeah.
First and Only came out, I want to say, in the late 90s.
Yeah. And
it predates the Horus Heresy.
Exactly. And we're just thinking in general of, like, you mentioned the time frames, and like I bought these from, surprisingly enough, from a local bookstore that the lady that owns it was a fan. And she had a big Black Library collection, and she actually had some first edition stuff that was like,
oh, crazy.
She was had priced for like $300, as she should, that I couldn't afford. But like, it's just so cool. Like, even like this one author that everyone loves that still is active writing for them, like 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know I mean? Like, oh my God, like, it's crazy.
And that's, and the other thing that's really weird is to talk about the late 90s and say almost 30 years ago, because it feels like it was yesterday. So we don't, the moral of the story is we don't know. We're probably going to have at least 5 more Horus Heresy episodes. So we'll probably have breaks because otherwise I start to lose my mind. It's a lot of research.
I just so happen to know a guy that knows all about Horus Heresy. That's also part of Improbable Wargaming.
Ah.
He lives in the Des Moines area.
I might have to have him on. We might have to have him join us at some point.
He'd probably know a lot more than I would, that's for sure.
Okay, so that was we wanted to get that flavor in connection to the content that we're covering right now. But you are an active member of our community here in the Midwest, in the Des Moines area, and you are also a commissioned painter.
Yeah, I've worn a lot of hats, and this is the current one I'm doing.
Okay.
As we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, I'm a painting presenter for Improbable Wargaming.
So right.
That's a all around, you know, Warhammer hobbying, you know, Battle Report YouTube channel. And just a bunch of friends, you know, so far there's 3 of us that are official members that have, you know, the community on for things. And yeah, it's huge. We're just trying to build a big, happy family.
Hell yeah. And I know that Steven and I are very singular, close in mindset. We have that, you know, how to stop the gatekeeping and how to embrace the idea that the hobby just needs to grow. We just want to see the hobby grow.
It already is. I mean, like, it's exploded in the last couple of years.
COVID was a huge.
Yeah.
And like, we're close to our Matt Mercer. I don't know who it's going to be, because I think there's like 7 top contenders right now, but we're close to getting our Matt Mercer.
You think it's blowing up now? Just wait until the Amazon Henry Cavill Warhammer series comes out.
Oh yeah.
We're going to see so many new people.
That's our Matt Mercer. It's Henry Cavill. Matt, if you somehow are listening to this specific episode and have completely ignored all of the things that I've said about you before in my role playing podcast that I used to run, Henry Cavill is, it's going to change. I mean, you know, Critical Role did something for Dungeons and Dragons, which I don't think even Wizards of the Coast was ready for. And like we're there. I feel like we're there. I feel like we're on the edge. Warhammer is on the edge of whatever that event is going to be.
Right.
All right. So I got some questions for you. This is an interview. So how did you get into tabletop gaming? Did anything specifically lead you from tabletop gaming in general into the world of miniatures gaming?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been holding off on my villain story this entire time we've been hanging out. So my origin has nothing to do with miniatures or Games Workshop or anything like that to begin with. When I got out of the army, I went to art school and like I was really looking for a community. And the first one I found was with a group of Viking Age reenactment people.
Okay.
And so that got me into just craft in general.
Okay.
And with that, I mean, I started developing skills and that kind of stuff. And then I got turned on to the Mandalorian Mercs, which is a costumed Star Wars group that goes to events and hospitals and kids and that kind of thing.
Yeah, they're like the 501st, but they're all Boba Fett,
right?
Mandalorian right. people, yep. Mandalorian guys.
And with that, I mean, I learned even more skills when it came to armor making with Sintra, like you mentioned, with the sign making stuff and all that stuff. I mean, I eventually then got into 3D printing. And I actually owned a 3D print shop for a good while, just an online-based one that resin printed and anything you could think of, making Mandalorian helmets, Stormtrooper helmets. And then I kept seeing this thing everywhere that there's miniatures, and I painted little Pokemon figurines for some friends of mine. And I was like, okay, there's this Warhammer thing. It's really expensive. I don't know if I can afford that. And then I bought a set of Space Marines, tried it out, and it's just, you fell in love. Yeah. And I think about it, and like I, back in Boy Scouts when I was a kid, like there was a, like there was a lock-in gaming thing that we all did that all the different troops came to. And I know there was a bunch of guys playing Bolt Action. And it, when I, once I found Warhammer, I had that repressed memory back to that. And I was like, I remember that being really cool.
Right, right.
And it's essentially a, an evolution of that. And I kind of skipped over it, but like when I, so I got into, which is weird because most people get into like Warhammer and that kind of stuff, and then they get into resin
3D printing. Yeah.
I did all that first.
Okay.
And so like I got into that and I started doing stuff. I have a bunch of friends that do Star Wars diorama. So I was making stuff for them, and I was making D&D minis. And then eventually you get sucked in.
Oh, like
everybody else does.
Miniatures is just the thing. So I've been working with 3D printing since 2014, 2015. However, largely that's because my day job, I'm an engineer for a toy company. Like home 3D, were you super early adopter into early 3D printing? Like, were you doing 3D printing in like 2014, 2015?
No, I was still in the Army in 2014.
Okay.
So, I be honest, for 40K, I've only been active for like going on maybe 3 years tops.
3 years.
But before that, I mean, I obviously have a bunch of painting experience and like with art school and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, so I'm still relatively new
to the hobby, to
Warhammer in general, but I feel like I brought a wealth of information from a bunch of other places
to it
for that.
Yeah.
Because I had a bunch of painting experience when it came to just prop making in general, which a lot of this stuff, it overlaps.
Oh yeah, it definitely does. So everybody in the pod who listens to the podcast kind of knows this, but I started playing in 92. I bought metal Eldari figures when I was like 12 with lawn mowing money. I went to buy Magic the Gathering cards because I lived in Washington State. And then I saw these really cool looking miniatures and I found out that they were space elves. And I was like, need them. I bought them. I still have them. They're in my Eldari army. They're fire dragon. No, fire dragons are my favorite. They're one of the metal sets. So I bought like five metal minis and the old blue second edition box. And that was it. That was my first introduction to Warhammer 40K. But one of the things that seems to happen a lot in the community, and a lot very specifically within the podcast and the podcast background, is Kevin and Beast, who are two of our other co-hosts. Thank you. There's a word. I'm grasping. Kevin and Beast, who are two of my other co-hosts, have a background in Renaissance Fair stuff and in Wasteland Weekend, which is Mad Max Renaissance Fair. It's the only way I can describe it. And then Mark, my co-producer, has a background in at least he's getting into Ren Fair now, but he went to Wasteland before he played Warhammer, but like he was part of that's actually how we all met. We all met because of Wasteland Weekend. And then we started podcasting about Warhammer 40K, not Mad Max. I know it would seem that we would have started a Mad Max lore podcast, but no, we started a 40K.
It works.
Like, how do we talk about orcs for like the rest of our lives and possibly make coffee money? Let's start a Warhammer 40K podcast. Perfect.
Perfect.
So the other through line that I've seen with a lot of people we've talked to is fabrication experience and Legos.
I've seen a lot of Legos. Legos is huge.
Lots of Lego knowledge. So I had mentioned to you earlier before we started recording that I've made several movies with my friends. There's a movie prop on the wall right there, which is a quarantine sign for a zombie film we worked on. Practical effects and prop making was really big when we were doing, we were part of the like 2010s, the 2010s to 2014s, if you want to say like YouTube shorts. Like we would do short action films and like contests, and we did like BlizzCon contests. We did all these little things. So like I've taken an entire empty school building and turned it into a spaceship and like stuff like that. So yeah, there I kind of obviously was doing Warhammer before that. I kind of like flowed in and out, but it totally makes sense. It totally 100% makes sense that a fabrication and artistic background leads to, and like you said, a lot of the skills are super similar.
Well, a lot of it too, at least for me, which I didn't realize at first how it tied in, but like you think of like, for example, Star Wars. I'm also wearing a Star Wars shirt.
You are.
Like ILM and like how all their methods for the most part, for the first few films were all miniatures.
Yeah.
And that team, they're all really skilled miniature people. So like I was watching Adam Savage.
Okay.
I
love Adam Savage.
I know. He's my hero. Like him and I have very similar personalities. And he was a model maker for ILM.
Yeah.
And he's showing that process. And I was like, this is where it ties in. I started in with, more or less like a Star Wars thing and like doing miniatures for those kind of people. And I mean, it's essentially like it all stemmed from the same place.
Yeah. It all kind of ties back. And it's the thing that I like about Adam Savage specifically and Savaged are tested. Mm-hmm. Obviously I liked him back in the Mythbusters days, but he brings that scratch build knowledge to the forefront. And that's the thing that I'm really big on. It's not really something, it is kind of something that is introduced in the terrain tutorial videos that we do, because I'm always like, here are some popsicle sticks. Here is some corrugated cardboard. Here's some of this. We're going to make it look like a ruined building. Like there's no kit. I'm showing you how I take disparate pieces and make it look like something different, which is scratch building. But I also like my orc vehicles are all being scratch built. I'm scratch building them all out of plastic card.
So sweet.
Because
I want to do that too.
Why? It, at a certain point, the kit, and don't get me wrong, the kits are beautiful. I love the kits. I love a lot of the kits, but my fire prisms are Carnosaurs with current fire prism crystals on them, but with old Falcon cockpits.
Yeah.
I kit bash and scratch build so much stuff because I wanted Eldari Exodites. I didn't want normal Eldari. I wanted, I want Mad Max orcs. I don't want normal orcs.
I think this is where like my story divulges from most of the people you have on this podcast, just because I didn't join the hobby for the game.
You joined it for the modeling.
I joined it for the modeling and the art, and like you'll see that with the things I do. Like I can knock out, units. I can do that. I have the skills for it. But like the thing that really gets my jellies going is like doing art with this medium.
Right. Yeah. It's another place to do art.
Right. And that's the thing you see with like the scratch build kits, like you see for like Adam Savage and that kind of stuff. It's like he's coming from that same place as it being an art form rather than a necessary means to an end. I need to get, models on the table to play.
Right. Right. So based on that, what was your reaction to, or do you even know about the Weta Workshop announcement that came out like 3 or 4 days ago?
I don't know.
So Weta Workshop is doing a licensed game, is doing something that's being licensed by Games Workshop. And they interviewed all of the guys that are going to be involved. And it was literally like, I work for Weta Workshop as a model builder on movies because as a kid, I played Warhammer 40K. And I've always been like they interviewed all these guys and it's just a, check it out. I wish I knew a little bit. Well, it's a teaser. We just know that they're working together, but it was cool to hear all the guys talk about like what they started doing in Warhammer 40K and how that led them to work for Weta Workshop.
Wouldn't it be cool? Cause like obviously we know this stuff's coming out for Amazon, right?
Oh, the Henry Cavill stuff. Yeah.
What if this is also spitball and like tinfoil? We'll get to the tinfoil hat stuff later, but a different one. Like what if this series that was made in the sense of like ILM model shop,
filmmaking. That
like they used miniatures.
That could be it.
To film, like not almost like, cause like, there's a we were talking about Starfield earlier. Like, there's a and Adam Savage did a Komoko like ship flying.
Yeah, he's building one of the ship. I think it's probably the series is probably over now, but I know that there was at least two videos on him scratch building the ship or one of the ships.
What if this new series has aspects of that?
That'd be mint. That'd be amazing. And that's the thing that, like, not to get back on the movie making side of things, but one of the things that differentiates plastic people, the Polar Express effect, if you will, from the Mass Effect speech effect from good CGI in films is, in my opinion, when there's a practical, but you're using CGI to finish the practical. Mm-hmm. You had a practical explosion, you're making it bigger. You had a practical blood effect, you're making it gorier. You had a practical starship, now you're just making it look a little bit more like it's in space. Like, you got to mix those two.
Yeah, and like in that's another thing that like it blends, you know, like in my head I just was thinking about weathering. Like, you think of prop design and prop making, and weathering is a huge part of that.
Oh yeah.
And what we do on the tabletop.
Weathering is absolutely huge in prop making.
You're just doing it at a micro scale with tabletop.
You don't have to worry so much about your paint lines when you're weathering an AK-47 that an actor is going to carry on screen.
Yeah, it's true. You had a point.
when you are painting a bolter, you really got to make sure that there's not a bunch of paintbrush marks in it. That's it. Thin your paints. I don't know. I'm learning it right now. I'm learning it still. I've been doing this for more than 30 years, right? 92 was more than 30. No. Yeah.
Almost. 30, it 30, is. Yeah.
31 years ago. I'm going to change. My origin story has changed. I've been playing Warhammer since 2012. I'm 14. I don't know. That doesn't work. I don't feel younger. All right. So what is your favorite? Warhammer 40K, Age of Sigmar, or the Old World, and why?
It's so hard. So I'm people are gonna laugh. Me being the person I am and being like a huge display painter. My gut says Ultramarines. People, I know they're vanilla, but here's the thing. My other background is an art background. And before that was a graphic design background. And so with that, I'm a huge proprietor of marketing and like the things that you see on posters, and that's what you see is you see Ultramarines.
Yeah, Ultramarines are the poster boy.
So those are the thing. That's the first thing that grabbed me. I was like, okay, these guys might be kind of cool. And so, I mean, it just stuck with me. But be honest, the thing that like I think's so cool is Seraphon and Lizardmen.
All right, Lizardmen are some of my. The concept of lizard people is one of my favorite sci-fi / fantasy tropes, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely love the lizard folk, the Seraphon to the lizard men. I absolutely love them.
The models are just so cool.
They're very cool. I really want to see what's coming because they're starting to drip out all of these like quasi technology things with them. But I'm like, are we going to see
lizards in space?
I want lizards. I really want lizards in space. So back in the day, 40K and fantasy were in the same universe. They're not anymore, maybe, kind of. That was our big tinfoil hat thing.
They kind of are, you know?
Yeah.
Because they have Sigmar as, you know,
So our big tinfoil hat thing with the Emperor and the Primarchs project, it's kind of still hanging around, vestigially hanging around, is that that Sigmar is the second Primarch. So the first of the lost Primarchs.
Oh.
And then that's one he's of the reasons he's lost. Yeah, I've heard that a lot too. Because he was the first Emperor of the Old World. But I think that's too on the nose. I think if they were to do it, he would be an Emperor or a Primarch.
Well, it's like, let's think about Stormcast Eternals. They're literally Thunder Warriors.
Yeah. Stormcast Eternals are cool. I have a bunch downstairs. They're cool. I have the Dominion. I had the Stormcast Eternal side of the Dominion box.
Especially when that box was like $100. Like, why wouldn't I buy it?
Well, somebody on the local marketplace was like, I have all the Stormcast Eternals from the Dominion box that I don't need. $20. And I was like, deal. Sold. That's my way. That's less than half the, and he gave me the box too. So like, nice. I'm a sucker for keeping some of the boxes. All right. So what appeals to you most? And I think I already know, but is it the lore? Is it the hobby or is it the game?
So definitely the hobby. So okay. the hobby was first and foremost. And like, it was another way for me to express myself artistically.
Right.
Cause like, right. I mean, I started out graphic design, changed majors, went straight studio art, and it was just a thing that clicked, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I did printmaking, I did paint, classical painting and all that kind of stuff, and metal work, and those things were all fun. I mean, I have a maker like spirit.
Right.
But like that, you know, miniatures is a mix of all those.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, 100%. A complete mix. Okay, so if I had to nail you down and make you pick a favorite Warhammer faction, you've already kind of outlaid Ultramarines and Seraphon, but if I were to make you give me a straight answer, which one? Or hit me completely randomly with like the fact that your actual favorite is like, I don't know, Gene Steeler Cult or something. Like.
No. I'd say if I mean, it's because Space Marines is so broad, it's hard to, I mean, I'm going to say Seraphon. If I had to pick one range to only paint ever again, it'd be Seraphon. Just because, I mean, there's a certain point you paint enough Space Marines, you're like, okay, I don't want to paint any more Space Marines, even though they're how cool they are. I mean, like, obviously, once the new jump pack ones come out, I'm definitely going to get those because those are sweet.
You're going to have to. I've got a Space Marine project. That it's a little heretical, but I came up with some lore that I really, really like. So it's the daughters or children of Isha, depending on how you look at it. And essentially, as the heresy was happening, so it's very well established that there are loyalist and traitor Marines in each legion. No, nobody went. No legion went cleanly 100% bad. There were always that element. Most of the time, they were the Terran-born Marines. But what I came up with was that Isha, being locked in Nurgle's garden, but being the goddess of healing, has always been whispering. And one of the things that Isha is said to do is that she whispers to the Eldari people and to the universe the cures for some of Nurgle's diseases. She figures out how Nurgle... So there's this whole idea that like Isha inspires the Medicaid to cure these diseases. So the idea that I came up with was that these are Death Guard who heard the whispers of Isha and fell from the Emperor to the Eldari, but they fell to the Eldari to fight against Nurgle specifically. So they're traitors. But they're not like, okay, so that's the first component of it.
They're like mid-tier traitors.
They're mid-tier traitors. They're renegades. So the second component of it is that a female Farseer, who I've named, I've written all this lore, I've named her and everything, I just can't remember off the top of my head. She got involved in the process before the Primarisification happened. And because of the Cabal, which goes back to Dan Abnett and the fact that the Cabal knew what was happening and the fact that the Cabal was like stealing technology and making their own perpetuals because of like John Chromaticus. And there's like a bunch of, I can back up because this is so broad. One, Warhammer 40K is so broad. You can make up whatever the fuck you want and nobody can tell you no. Two, it's so broad that there's so many like different facts and like conspiracy threads and like one-liners that you can use to like prove anything. So the Cabal knew how to make Space Marines and may have even known how to make Primaris Space Marines, because now we know that Primaris Space Marines have been worked on for 10,000 years. So they stole the technology. This Farseer got the technology in hand. So these Death Guard are sent by this Farseer to fight against Nurgle. And they show up on battlefields that the Imperium is fighting on, and that they come out of the mists and they fight for on the side of humans, but with Eldari troops like are next to them or whatever. And then they vanish again. They're kind of like the Legion of the Damned. They show up and then they vanish again. And when they vanish again, sometimes they take the most wounded soldiers with them, like Imperial Guardsmen. Well, since this Farseer has Eldari technology and like super science and knows the primarisification, the space marine process, she will take a 40-year-old guardsman and make him into a space marine without failure because Eldari technology.
Heresy.
Yeah, I know. The other thing that happens is if the guard unit they save, like say, so essentially the idea is like they're not doing it on purpose, but if they come across a guard unit and there's like six people left, they'll be like, you know, stick with us. We'll make sure you get through it. And they'll take them back to the what are they called? Craft world. They'll take them back to the craft world. And then the Farseer gives them a choice. You can join us or we can drop you off. Like you have no way of finding out where we are. We can reunite you with humans or you can join us. And then if you chose to join them, you go through the process of becoming a space marine. Well, if that guard unit is 50% women or 100% women, I have Eldari technology that has allowed me to perfect the space marine process. Do you want to be a space marine?
This is where the conspiracy comes in.
So the daughters of Isha, the children of Isha, have female space marines because there is no reason for the process not to work. So they're going to be painted Dusk Raider colors, but in all of this is the problem with doing projects like this. Every single Aquila, every single skull, all of that's being shaved off and I'm replacing it with soul stones. Because the idea is these troops understand the hardships of being an Eldar. So when they're deployed along with their Eldari brothers, because that's how they see themselves at this point, they want to have a soul stone in case something happens and that dude's soul can't be trapped in his own armor. It'll get trapped in my armor and then I can take him back to the Infinity Circuit. Wow. Essentially. So it's all thought out.
Well thought out.
It is such a project because I like shaving the skull, especially off the Primaris, because I bought all Primaris stuff. Because I like True Scale. I'm a little torn on Primaris lore, but anyway, that was a long ass segue.
Well, what you just described is how 90% of the space marine factions were formed in the '80s.
Right. And it's literally just like, hey, I have a weird idea. And this whole thing came out of a meme. I saw a meme of good Death Guard in the 41st millennium. And it was a joke. It was like the great unclean one.
Yeah.
But it was like
cleaned up.
Yeah. It was like what if the Death Guard was cleaned up? And I'm like, that's an awesome idea. What if there were Death Guard who followed Isha instead of Nurgle? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, and it's heresy on like six levels, but, yeah. The other idea that I've had recently, because you brought up bolt action earlier and I almost said something, but I'm going to run it by you. A lot of people who like bolt action are very dedicated to historical reenactment, which is fiction, but they're very dedicated to historical reenactment. And I like all of the crazy, like Wunderwaffen technology, the Germans came up with weird shit. And it's cool. So my idea,
tubes and
yeah, my idea was because the bolt action line has all of the crazy tanks was like, so what if a bunch of grots fell into a time portal and got transported back to like 1938 Germany and somehow got a bunch of tanks from the Nazis and just made their own faction. And like, I pitched it to the bolt action guys. Cause like, I want to play with the German tanks, but like, I don't want to be associated with German anything. Mm-hmm. They got real mad.
Yeah. They don't like that.
They don't like the goblin Germans. I'm like, why not? It's like, it solves all the issues. You guys don't have to be worried that I'm a weirdo. I don't have to be worried that I'm a weirdo. And now it's not the Americans fighting the Americans fighting the Americans.
Yeah. The thing, definitely with those guys, when those guys get down to the point, like this color tank was this exact shade of paint. It was being color matched to the exact paint that was used during this particular battle. But this different battle had a different paint because they got paint from a different manufacturer. Like they get that. They get that deep.
Oh yeah. Well, and one of the things that I didn't realize because I grew up with Steven Spielberg and George Lucas translating World War II into entertainment, whether or not that was the dogfights of Star Wars, which is 100% why there's dogfighting in Star Wars is because of the dogfights in World War II, or whether or not that was the proto Saving Private Ryan stuff that one or both of them worked on. I grew up with this like Hollywood version of World War II.
Oh, definitely. I think all of us do.
Yeah. And this came up most recently with the preview for that movie Zizou, where it's like it's this dude who's mining gold in Finland, and like a retreating SS like tank division comes across him and decides to steal his gold, and he's like one of the like Finnish special troops that was like saving people from concentration camps. Yeah. So of course he goes on like a John Wick one man army crusade, but people were like, that's a T-60 Russian tank from the Cold War, not just painted to look like a German tank. And I'm like, why do you know that? Yeah. To me, it's painted German colors and the dudes in it are dressed as SS officers. Done. I get that it's not a tank that was made in the 1940s, but how many of those do you think are still around?
Yeah. It's
2023. They're using a tank from the 60s?
Yeah,
good sure. on them.
And if you want to get into some cool like actual historical lore, like military stuff, like there's a bunch of badass Finnish guys that just murked all kinds of Russians, so and, like
yeah, that's
look what, into it, it's awesome.
That's what this dude's based on. He's based on that like that idea. All right, so that was a weird tangent, but yeah, the more I think about it, the more I'm making my Grot bolt action German army. And like, I'll change the symbol to a different symbol. Everyone will get, it'll just be like, it'll just be a Grot face. Everybody will get mad at me, but I'll be like, look, like.
Win a play or not.
Yeah. Sorry. Like that one. Are you kind of laughing? I'm kind of laughing. Then don't be mad about it. Like two, do you really expect the dude with the Jewish mother to like really? Do you think the guy with Jewish parents are going to, you know, come on. All right. So what's your favorite piece of lore?
Okay. So, I mean, my favorite piece of lore, I mean, I shouldn't say a piece. Like I've been reading the Gaunt's Ghost books.
Okay.
And I brought First and Only.
Great book. Absolutely great book. Fantastic book.
I mean, for me, my connection to it is it's a personal one. It's because I was in the army and I was a part of a reconnaissance unit and snipers and all that kind of cool stuff. And that's essentially what
you were a ghost.
I mean, in a way, I mean, like we had a lot of similarities in our unit to the Tanith and that kind of stuff. And I identified with a lot of the characters in it with people that I knew personally, and I could place them with people I knew. And it was kind of, I mean, like it was one of the few books that like I read and like, I like didn't cry because men don't cry, but like, was like to the verge of thinking about like
get back in there too.
Well, kind of yeah, like thinking about like the connections of what was going on and things that happened in my own life, and like you almost think about like, man, like I kind of feel like I'm tearing up right now just because of this. It feels like, at least for me, because I have that connection,
right?
But
right.
Like and that's also Dan Abnett's writing. It's just like he does, like, hey, these characters are not your best friends.
Well, and the interesting thing about Dan Abnett's writing is that there's stuff that came out of the Gaunt's Ghost books that was not Warhammer lore before he wrote it. Like,
oh, yeah.
Vox is a Dan Abnett thing.
Nice.
He came up with the idea of like Vox casters and like it. Yeah, you know, obviously there was communication devices on the models before a name was put to it, but he put the name to it. Mm. Yeah, the Tanith First and Only. I used to have a enormous Imperial Guard army. It's one of the only armies that I've sold. Well, it's not one of the only. I sold several fantasy armies and I sold my Imperial Guard army. But my Imperial Guard army was Catachan and Cadia mixed, Cadians mixed, because that was, you know, fourth edition, that was the kits that existed. And I was specifically like, because I had those two to mix together, I was specifically doing them as Tanith First and Only. Because nice. It just, you know, like the Tanith aren't getting reinforced by Tanith, because spoiler alert for a book that was written in like what, 95?
Something like that, yeah.
The planet's gone. But like, that was
right,
just
right away. Alert.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I guess it's not really a spoiler. It happens in the first like five pages of the book. Is it on the back cover? It's probably it on is, the actually. Back cover. If you read the summary, it's been spoiled. But yeah, so there's no way to get troops from Tanith. So the whole idea was like, oh, well, whoever reinforces the Tanith is who reinforces the Tanith. And that was essentially what I was doing. I had the old metal unit.
Those models are so grody, but like it's cool because the history. Yeah. But
I sold them to Kev, one of my co-hosts. I really like the plastic ones.
Oh yeah.
But
I want to do a kill team with them somehow.
Yeah, you probably just run them as a kill team, I would think.
Yeah, they fit certain parts of it, but I think for kill team, I think they have like 16 models. So I mean, I'll have to
figure it out
stuff with that, but.
All right, so you have been commission painting for how long?
I'd say commission painting about 2 years.
And you've been doing?
About a year and a half.
Painting tutorials for 6 months?
Say 6 months, 8 months-ish.
Okay. So what are your...
I taught painting classes before that in person.
Okay. For miniatures or just painting classes in general? Yeah. For miniatures. So what are your top three tips for miniature painters at any skill level? Like don't give me three for beginners, three for medium, three for experts. What are your top three that cover the entire? Okay.
Yeah. First one is just to stop thinking about it. Just do it. Yeah. Put your paintbrush on there and put something and see how it works.
Right.
And like what's going to make you better is just the muscle memory of your hand holding a brush and putting it to a model. Like you can watch as many videos as you want, but you're not going to learn that from a video.
Yeah,
so definitely. That's number one. I think that's most people's number one. Number two is going to be, don't be afraid to get an airbrush.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
a game changer.
It's a tool for a reason. You know, obviously you got to develop skills to be able to do things like that with a brush. But I mean, at this point, like that technology it's so accessible. You can get a beginner airbrush. Mind you, it might not be the best experience to use, but like $40-$50.
Would you recommend a place to get an airbrush like that? Cause that's actually a question that we've been asked before is like, where, like, you know, I've got a Badger Chrome, so I have like $150 airbrush, and then I've got an Iowata Ninja, which is like a $150 compressor, which to a lot of people is a daunting introduction to the tool set.
Yeah. And like, I mean, Amazon's a good place, but I'm not affiliated with this particular company, but I go through a place called Spray Gunner a lot.
Spray Gunner. Okay.
And they have a line of products, which are, essentially those same like Chinese cheap products you would get, from Amazon for cheap. But one cheaper cause they know what they are and they like that's expected, but they've also been, you're not buying them directly from China untested. They get them, they test them, make sure everything is, so you don't have those issues. You get like, oh, this compressor doesn't work because I bought.
Right.
Because like, everything's, right. So they have that and they're still cheap.
Have you ever had I'm cutting you off, but have you ever had an air compressor seize on you?
I've had one like, not, yeah. I mean, because I bought, Ninjun has a video where he talks about a compressor.
Yeah.
It's a handheld one. I got that one and it lasted me like a year. Okay. Before it, like it didn't blow up, but it stopped working.
So I had I came to airbrush. So my background is in illustration and art history. I started off as a literature major, but I changed to illustration and art history. I still have it. I have a like the top of the line Pache airbrush, mm-hmm. for like painting murals and people. Cause yeah. I did a lot of body painting. When I was in college and right after college, I painted a lot of naked people into other things.
As one does.
It pays really well. Regardless of what you think about body painting, the human body and specifically the female human body is not fun to paint. they're great to look at, but that is not, it's not a canvas. it's not flat. And they kind of do whatever they want. They move on their own. Gravity affects stuff. Yeah, people breathe. Body painting is not the sexy thing that people think it is. It's actually a huge pain in the ass. But I did a lot of body painting and all that. So I had a Pache. And I had this old, like, bought at a hobby store, like, Gunter 129 made in, you know, Wisconsin, like, blue.
Oh yeah.
Industrial looking compressor. And I was on set painting. I ran a prosthetics company. I'd say worked for, but I was within the top three. I ran a prosthetics company for a very short period of time, as far as like movie prosthetics, not like people. Like we did fake bullet holes and like vampire teeth marks. And we were like a hobby, not Hobby Lobby. What's the costume one? Party City. We sold a lot of the like stuff that you can go to Party City and buy for Halloween stuff. Some of the stuff that we worked on and sculpted and all that's actually still out there. But anyway, so I was working for that company. We were doing some promo video stuff. So it was essentially like applying, I was applying a razor blade to, or not a razor blade, a straight razor wound to a to an actress's neck for a photo shoot. But like part of it was we did the photo shoot, but we're doing the process. We're showing the whole airbrush process. And so an airbrush compressor is essentially a big motor. It's a huge chunk of copper that spins real fast. So it seized and the airbrush compressor just went like across the floor because there was that much inertia. And that was an expensive airbrush compressor. That was like a $350 airbrush compressor. So anyway, that was my college airbrush compressor. It didn't last very long.
For sure. So definitely, it's getting into airbrushing is easier to get into than getting into Warhammer. So
I wondered, because you can paint anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to paint Warhammer.
And when looking at how to use it, look at places other than Warhammer, because people have been airbrushing things like t-shirts and paintings, actual fine art paintings,
RC airbrushes cars,
I don't even know how long, for 100 years.
And you don't have to start with miniatures. You can start with miniatures, but you don't have to start with Battle Captain 5. You can paint a Bane Blade.
Yep.
That could be your first, or terrain. I always tell people that are trying to get into airbrushing, prime with the airbrush, paint terrain with your airbrush. And realistically, other than maybe like some base coloring, I don't really paint with the airbrush. I'll just do my base color. Or my base colors, but anyway, what's your third tip? Because I go to Outer Siberia a lot.
So my third tip would be find you somebody that can give you actual constructive advice on your painting and use them frequently. So meaning anywhere you can go on Discord, Facebook, and post a picture and get 1,000. Man, that looks great.
Yeah,
but. Well, that's great for your ego and that'll help you paint more because you feel good. The actual technical skills, having somebody telling you like, hey, like you could have done this one thing a little bit different. Another, hey, maybe add another highlight here. Like having somebody like that you can listen to and that like you kind of have to like hold back the little bit of like ego of like, oh man, he's telling me I'm doing something wrong. But it's important for growth, I think.
So here's two thoughts that came off of that. The first one is the miniatures community is really supportive. There's a lot of hate in the miniatures community. As far as like painting, there's a lot of weird things that happen in other ways. Like gamer rage is definitely, table rage is definitely a thing. But when it comes to the hobby side, there's not a lot of hate that happens, which can be detrimental because you don't get a lot of constructive criticism. But the other thing that I've noticed is that maybe because you also went to art school, giving and taking constructive criticism, it's a class. Like you're taught how to deal with it. Because you have to accept it and not egotize it. And then you have to be able to also give it. Like, because if I look at a minute, and we try to do that with our painting contest stuff. If I look at your miniature and there's a couple of things I can point out and give to, like, I really like everything you did here, but, you know, I can see the seam down the center, which is distracting because of this, or I like everything you did here, but your, one of the things that was interesting, and it's an interesting problem to get around. And we've got a member of our community who's doing a bunch with it right now. And they're starting to get around it is like aquarium plants, plastic aquarium plants, great for Death Worlds, except for the fact that they look like plastic aquarium plants.
Right.
So there, we had a guy that did a beautiful model. And then he even won, but he had done the basing, he had done the basing with plastic aquarium plants. And that was my only criticism was
if you can tell,
figure out how to tone down, like even if you're just matte varnishing it, like figure out how to tone down that like mass produced plastic look. And it can be difficult to phrase that. If you're just getting into the community, into any community, even like D&D community, writing community, any community, and you just, you identify that you're not happy with what you're looking at or with what you just read, or you're not totally happy with it, you've got to take a minute to on the critique side, you have to take a minute to formulate what is actually bugging you to help the artist grow. And then the artist, as you said, has to be willing to take it.
Yeah. It happens like all the time. And like, it's not ministry specific, like so I work for a school district, and the art teacher comes up to me all the time with a drawing being like, what is wrong with this? And like, cause she knows that like all like an outside eye will find things that she can't. Hey, you have your calf backwards. The ball of the calf is on the front of the leg. Like, well, that's why it's looking goofy.
Right.
It's
right.
Little things like that, that like using each other as a set of, cause like, You look at your miniature and for hours on end.
Yeah, you've spent hours looking at it. You're not seeing it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then you pull. That's another thing. Like even just pulling away for a little bit and looking at it with fresh eyes later on.
Graphic designers and commercial artists quite often get up and look at their piece from across the room. Or tilt their head or turn their monitors sideways or turn the image upside down in like Photoshop, because just try to look at it from a different perspective. And because you'll catch those things that like you're not seeing because you're too invested in it.
And so be a good friend, give good advice.
Ask for good advice, give good advice. Yeah. I like it. All right. How do you stay motivated to paint? And this is a big one for you, because not only are you doing commission paint jobs, but you're painting your own stuff.
Yeah. So for me, that I mean, I wish if I had the exact answer, it would. I wish I knew
because $20,000 question.
Yeah, so that I could tap into it more regularly. So for me, like I have like raging like ADHD.
Okay.
So when it comes to like a hyper focus on a thing I'm super interested about.
Right.
That's like, oh man, I'm all in it. But finding the motivation for things that just need done, I kind of have to search for it. So for me, like it's like Tau, for example. I was talking about that huge commission I'm doing for Steven. I wouldn't paint Tau otherwise. So I was like, okay, let's go find something that my brain likes that I'll latch onto. So I find that, and then I find, oh, okay, they're based in, you know, Asian culture and that kind of stuff. And then being like, okay, let's find a cool creative art thing to attach to it that's going to make my brain go, make my brain actually work.
right. So that the funny thing is, I didn't want to diatribe about it at the time, but I'm going to diatribe about it now. A lot of people make the communist Tau joke. That's the joke. The joke is always like, come with me, comrade.
Yeah.
Let's go to great Russia. The thing that's interesting about that, I mentioned Dan Carlin already, but I'm going to bring him up again. He did, I think it's called Supernova in the East, where he's talking about the lead up to Japan and in a way, well, he's talking about the lead up to Japan's involvement in the Second World War and what Japan did to potentially attempt to colonize China. The interesting thing that I learned about listening to that is that the kamikaze pilots often painted in Japanese characters for the greater good on their aircraft.
Interesting.
The Tau are so based in imperial colonial Japanese pre-1946 Japanese imperial culture. Like, so much like the caste system, the fact that there is an entire warrior caste that I realize they're not fighting with swords, but fire warriors are a samurai class. Everything about the Tau has so much more to do with imperialistic Japanese history than it does with anything communist, but for the greater good in a post McCarthy world is the Red Scare.
But then with that, I mean, like you have, your tie into other things, like the reason why I love The Mandalorian is its huge tie into Westerns and samurai film.
Right.
And like
the crossover,
you can get that same thing with Tau. So like Farsight, for example, being like the renegade Ronin type of
the Farsight enclaves. Yeah.
And so when finding those connections, that your brain can go, okay, yeah, now that's cool.
That's awesome.
That's where you'll get your motivation from. For me anyway, that and caffeine, lots of caffeine.
That's the reason that I brought it up, because the the Farsight you did with the Sakura leaves, the Japanese temple and the Sakura leaves kind of like drifting across it's awesome. There's a video. If you guys are listening, check out at brandon.pillow.art on Instagram, or look up Improbable Wargaming on YouTube. I don't know if you have it on your TikTok, but I know that I've seen it on your Instagram. Look it up, check it out. It's an amazing piece. And you did that for Steven. That's not yours.
Yeah, it's not. I don't get to keep that, unfortunately. It might end up going to LVO as a single figure piece, but nice. I don't know yet. Nice. Yeah, it's still iffy about that. But I mean, yeah, that's the thing is, like, otherwise, I mean, I wouldn't have even learned Tau lore. I mean, yeah. Obviously, it was a necessity. I needed to get into the zone to do that commission.
Right.
But
right.
I mean,
you want to be in the headspace.
Yeah, but then you find things that connect because, like, I already like samurai movies.
Okay, so we're getting to the meaty stuff. This is the segment we called Warhammer Tinfoil Hat Moment. Oh, so yeah, what is your Warhammer Tinfoil Hat Moment? It can be of the week. It doesn't have to be your overall one because we seem to come up with new ones every week.
So I definitely didn't have one at first. I was trying to think of one that would ruffle the most feathers. And so
let's be as controversial as possible.
So, I mean, you've already hit the female space marines in this episode. So
I ripped that Band-Aid off.
I was thinking this one, we can have the magical powers that orcs have.
Okay.
It's the exact same magical powers the sisters have.
But the sisters of battle have. So it's that. Well,
power, belief.
It is.
And faith.
It is.
Orcs believe and it happens.
It's
the sisters believe in the
Emperor. It happens.
And they have power. It's the exact same thing.
And that's the thing that's interesting about that is the sisters of battle are tapping into the warp. Like, they're calling it saints, but it's warp power.
Oh, yeah.
It's totally warp power. And WOG power is warp power. It's just, it's different ways to get to the same place. I like that. I like that a lot. That's a good one. I mean, if your feathers weren't ruffled, hopefully they're ruffled now. Well, thank you very much for coming on for the community spotlight. Once again, let everybody know where they can kind of find you.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can find me on YouTube, Improbable Wargaming. I do painting videos, and also on Instagram is my main place that I post things. And that's brandon.pillow.art.
Awesome. And hopefully we can get you to come on and be a guest judge in one of our painting contests, and then hopefully we can get you to submit a model for one of our painting contests. We do give like 2 months to paint, so it should be something you can work with. Hopefully. It'd be great to have you compete for a red squig. It'd be great to get you to tear our paint jobs apart. I always love hearing it's always good. good to get good critiques.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, like you said, it's like it's almost like a class itself is learning how to critique in art school.
Oh, it 100% is. Well, thank you very much, listeners, for joining us on this episode. If you would like to get into contact with us, you can get into contact with the show by emailing either underthehiveofmadness@gmail.com or jimdarkgaming@gmail.com. If you'd like to get a hold of Brandon, again, check out at brandon.pillow.art on Instagram or Improbable Wargaming on YouTube. You can also most likely now connect to him through our Discord. He'll have an invite, but you can also connect with the rest of us through Discord.
Yeah. So, Improbable Wargaming has their own Discord. Community is about 400 people strong and growing every single day. So there's people there that'll, if you have a question for anything, like they'll have an answer for you.
You'll even get me answering lore questions.
Yeah.
another way that you can get a hold of us is obviously through the various Discords. We talk about Warhammer 40K, Warhammer Age of Sigmar, Warhammer Fantasy Battle, Magic the Gathering, Dungeons and Dragons, role-playing games, video games, pretty much everything in the nerdosphere. You can also find us through Instagram, through Facebook, and I am on TikTok. Or you mentioned you're on TikTok. Is it still
Brandon,
the same one?
Yep.
It's where you find everything under one. That's the way to do it.
If you're listening to this currently, there's also a special segment that we recorded just for patrons.
Oh, that's true.
Segment. And also, Improbable Wargaming is also on Patreon.
Yeah.
And at the $20 tier, you get a monthly painting class with me.
Oh, that's cool. That, hey, there you go. Yeah, if you guys want to, you can also check us out on our website, www.underthehiveofmadness.com. If you liked the podcast episode, please like and review us wherever you get your podcast fix. Our home is Spotify, but you can find us on Apple, Google, Audible, Stitcher, which is now Pandora, and many, many more. If you are interested in joining our Patreon, it's patreon.com/underthehiveofmadness. There you'll find extra content like the video version of the podcast. There's a video component where you can watch, you can see both of our beautiful faces. You can see the models that Brandon brought, some of the models Brandon brought here. We'll do even more of a show off of the models that Brandon brought right now for everybody. But you can catch our episodes with the bloopers left in. I don't do a heck of a lot of editing, so if we said something dumb or I flubbed over an intro like three times, it's there. You can also get involved in our quarterly painting contest when you join our Patreon, plus we have started to do monthly giveaways. Our next giveaway, for those of you who might be interested, is actually one of these awesome dry brush palettes that Brandon cut for us. Laser cut for us. And there's some other content over there, so I definitely suggest you go on and check it out. We've been through about 15 of these relay stations, and so far all we've seemed to have found are some glass eaters that they're pretty out of their mind on glass. So pretty good day. I don't know how many four-armed emperors you were hoping to bag down here, if you wanted to take home some fangs or claws or ears. I guess they don't have ears. But I guess we haven't really come across anything super scary.
As long as there's money at the end, I'm okay.
There you go. We are the ravenous villains of rebellion your mama warned you about. 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio, reminding all of you Chemrats, hive mice, and sump ghoulies to keep those dials fixed right here. Same ratty station for a dose of the same ratty ass attitude. The last thing I saw was my alarm clock flashing 12:07 as it pushed its long, razor-sharpened claws through my chest, while one of its other claws muffled my screams. I sat bolt upright, relieved. It was only a dream. That's when I saw my alarm clock, which read 12:05, and I heard my closet door slowly creak open, and the shadow of a four-armed emperor fell across my sheets.
Stay strapped or get snacked.
Stay strapped or get snacked. And read a fucking book. If you take anything away from our podcast, read a fucking book.
Or audiobook.